15-week fetus was about the size of an apple, maybe 4 inches long. But this thing on the screen, it was sucking its thumb. It had hair and eyebrows and fingernails. It looked like it could crawl already. As she stared at the ultrasound screen, she noticed that the movements and twitches of the fetus were repetitive. It was playing on a loop. Joy cleared her throat. "I think maybe there's been a misunderstanding," she said. "I'm here for an abortion."
"You know, if you get an abortion, you probably won't be able to have children, ever. And that's if you survive in the first place," Maria said.
She went on,
"Do you go to church? Does your boyfriend?"
Even these questions sounded enthusiastic.
"If you've let Jesus into your heart," Maria said, "he doesn't want you to kill your baby."
By now, Joy was utterly confused. "I think I've made a mistake." Maria grasped her arm.
"I am so glad to hear you say that. We can help you, Joy. We can help you and your child. We have lots of resources on adoption."
A suspicion crept into Joy's head. "I need to think about it," she said, pulling down her shirt and sitting up. Maria brightened.
"There's no rush."
Even that was a lie. Joy knew she had exactly 4 days before she could no longer legally have an abortion in the state of Mississippi. It wasn't until she was out on the street, breathing hard, that she looked up and saw the actual center across the street. She ran past the protesters who shouted at her and repeatedly pressed the intercom button. The electronic door lock buzzed, and Joy hurried inside.
"Is this the center?"
she asked the woman at the reception desk, who nodded.
"You're sure?"
"I better be, since I own the place. Do you have an appointment?"
She had a name tag, Vanita. When Joy apologized for being late, Vanita knew exactly what had happened.
"Goddamn pregnancy crisis center," Vanita said, "pardon my French. They're like weeds, sprouting up next to every abortion clinic, to purposely confuse patients."
"I'm pretty sure they're a bunch of quacks."
"I know they are," Vanita said. "The state's got us jumping through 100 legal hoops just to keep our license, and they're completely unvetted. They tell you we don't have real doctors here, and that you'll probably bleed to death."
She shook her head. "You're more likely to be hit by a bus crossing the street to get here than you are to die from complications from an abortion. You're more likely to die from sneaking into an abortion clinic to make some kind of moral point." With a sinking feeling, Joy realized that Janine had gotten what she wanted. It may not have been the way she intended, but in all likelihood, this clinic was now going to close. If not permanently, then temporarily. Vanita, the owner, was dead. And who would be willing to come here after this? What would happen to women like Joy, who were 15 weeks pregnant and scheduled for an abortion tomorrow or the day after? Joy glanced down at Janine's sprawled body again. It just went to show you. There was no right way to do the wrong thing, except to not do it at all. She could feel the prickle of everyone else's eyes on her as she slowly knelt on the carpet in front of Janine. Go figure. When you cradled a liar's head in your lap, it felt just like anyone else's. In a way, Olive thought, being in the dark was even harder than being out there with the others. She could hear conversations, stomping, crashes. She knew when the shooter was angry, and she knew when someone was in pain. But because she couldn't actually see with her own eyes, she began to paint pictures in her mind of what was happening. And what she could dream with a fertile imagination had to be much worse than the reality. Right? Beside her, Ren shuddered.
Do you think he killed her?
There was no need to ask who. The woman who had been babbling about how they kill babies here had fallen silent after a heavy thud.
He didn't shoot her, Olive whispered. That doesn't mean she's alive.
The brain can do a lot of things, Olive said, but it can't distinguish between what's really happening and what you're imagining. That's why scary movies scare you, and why you cry at Nicholas Sparks' books.
Who?
Never mind.
You talk like a teacher, Ren said.
Guilty as charged, Olive said. I used to teach at the college. She considered the woman who'd insisted she did not belong here. Olive could have said the same. The center was all about reproductive choices, and she didn't have any of those left. But she would never have jeopardized Ren's life by throwing open the closet door to save her own skin.
If I die, Ren murmured, they'll make a shrine at school.
Olive turned at the sound of her voice.
They'll put flowers underneath my locker and posters saying rest in peace and photos of me doing stupid things, like with my face painted for Spirit Day or dressed like Supergirl for Halloween. It happened last year with a girl who died of leukemia.
Ren said softly,
all these people pretending they miss me when they never even knew me.
Olive reached for her hand and squeezed it.
You're not going to die, she said.
As if to punctuate her promise, Ren's phone buzzed. Are you still safe? Hugh texted. Those three dots appeared, scrolling, and he let out the breath he was holding.
There was someone yelling, and then a thud, and now it's quiet.
He wondered how many women were in there, other than his daughter and his sister. He knew his responsibility was to every hostage inside the center, but the truth was, he was thinking only of Bex and Ren. Aunt Bex? He typed. Question mark, question mark, question mark.
Don't know.
When he was a kid, and he'd gone somewhere after school, Bex used to insist that he call her when he arrived. He hated it. It made him feel like he was the biggest loser. It wasn't until he had Ren and worried about her every minute she wasn't with him that he understood why his sister had been so vigilant. The reason you hold on to someone too tightly isn't always to protect them. Sometimes it's to protect yourself. Hugh stared down at his phone as if he could will Ren courage, strength, hope. Stay calm, he texted. Dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot.
Daddy,
Ren wrote.
I'm scared.
She had not called him Daddy for a long time. When Ren was little, Hugh had come upstairs to find her scrubbing her face with lemons, trying to get rid of her freckles.
I have spots, she had said. I'm ugly.
You're beautiful, he'd told her, and those are constellations. The truth was, she was his universe. Parenthood was like awakening to find a soap bubble in the cup of your palm, and being told you had to carry it while you parachuted from a dizzying height, climbed a mountain range, battled on the front lines. All you wanted to do was tuck it away, safe from natural disasters and violence and prejudice and sarcasm. But that was not an option. You lived in daily fear of watching it burst, of breaking it yourself. Somehow you knew that if it disappeared, you would too. He wondered if the women who'd come to the center thought differently. Then, reconsidering, he imagined it was exactly what they thought. I'm here,
he texted Ren. And he hoped that would be enough.
Beth stared at the strange man in her room, a cop. Not outside the door, but inside it, and watching her. It was creepy as fuck. As if it weren't bad enough that she was handcuffed to the bed rail. She wanted her father. She wished she could text him, apologize, cry, beg. But her phone had been taken away by the police. Was he in the hospital cafeteria, or taking a walk, or just sitting in his car and replaying the horrible things they had said to each other? Beth knew that if she could see his face, talk to him directly, she could make him see that nothing had changed, that she still needed him as much as, if not more than, before. She would spend a month in church with him if he wanted, atoning for her sins. She would do anything to go back to the way it had been. When the door opened, she turned, hope swelling. But she hadn't conjured her father at all. It was a strange man in a suit, with a shock of dark hair. He was followed by a stenographer who set up a machine in the corner near the radiator.
"Hello, Beth," he said. "I'm Assistant District Attorney Willie Cork. How are you doing?"
She looked from this man to the cop, and then her eyes settled on the stenographer, a woman. When she was little and had to go pee, her father used to ask a woman to take her into the ladies' room. He used to say if she ever felt like she needed help, she should find someone who looked like a good mother. Which, she realized with a shock, disqualified Beth herself. Maybe he was her lawyer. She had asked for one. She wasn't quite sure how that worked.
"Hello,"
Beth said softly, and at that moment the door flew open again and a small tornado cycled in. She was tiny and black, and the air crackled around her.
"Your pasty manhood might get you a pass in just about everything in this country, Willie, but even you know better than this. You don't get to talk to my client without representation present." "Such a warm welcome, counselor," the ADA drawled. "Guess you've missed me."
"Willie, when it comes to you, a tiny bit goes a long way. Like arsenic or nuclear fallout." She glanced down at the hospital bed. "My name is Mandy Duville. I'm your public defender. You're Beth, yes?" Beth nodded.
"Okay, Beth. Do not talk to anyone unless I'm present, understand?"
She faced the prosecutor.
"Why are you even here? Don't you have bigger things to do? Like passing a bogus voter ID law or gerrymandering the districts before your next election?" "Officer Raymond here called me down to the scene, and rightly so," Willie Cork said. "I have never seen anything so disturbing in all my years serving Lady Justice. We had an arrest warrant within the hour."
Mandy slid a glance toward the cop at the door. "Nathan," she greeted.
"'Cuz," he said.
The prosecutor handed Mandy a file.
"Knock yourself out," he said,
and Beth's lawyer opened the folder and began to read, her eyes flying back and forth.
"Self-abortion," Mandy read.
"Pills?" Her lawyer snapped the folder shut and focused her gaze on Beth's handcuffed wrist, awkwardly balanced on the rail.
"She's a child. Maybe 100 pounds soaking wet. Is that really necessary?"
she asked Willie.
"This woman is a murderer," the prosecutor said. "Alleged murderer."
Beth's eyes darted from person to person. It was like they were playing tennis, and she was the ball being volleyed back and forth. She shifted, jingling the chain on her wrist.
"I didn't..." "Stop talking," Mandy interrupted loudly, holding up her palm.
"Nathan," she asked, "can I please lean over and whisper to my client for a moment of confidentiality?"
"That's Officer Raymond to you," Nathan said.
And no, you'll stay 2 feet away from the defendant at all times.
The public defender rolled her eyes. Beth, I need you to tell me if you understand what the state is saying you did. Not whether or not you actually did it. Beth blinked at Mandy, utterly confused.
Okay, I'm going to enter a not guilty plea on your behalf and waive the bail argument until you're released from here and transported to the prison.
Beth's jaw dropped.
Prison?
Just then, the door to the room opened and the hospital security guard crammed himself inside, followed by a bailiff who was easily 70 and another man who changed the entire tone in the room. Immediately, both lawyers stood a little straighter. The cop put his hand on his weapon and wedged himself between Beth and the judge. The other security guard pushed Mandy further away from Beth to clear a path.
She's not Charlie Manson, Mandy murmured.
All rise, the bailiff announced, and Beth looked down at her legs in the hospital bed. The Honorable Judge P. No of the Third Circuit Judicial District Court.
The prosecutor offered Pinot an oily smile.
Your Honor, he said, did I hear that you shot under 80 last week at the country club? None of your damn business, Cork, the judge muttered. I hate hospital arraignments.
He stared down at the only chair in the room, which was occupied by the stenographer.
Is there not another seat? There isn't much room in here, the bailiff said. Maybe we make some by getting rid of what's extraneous, starting with you. But, Your Honor, the bailiff insisted, I'm here to protect you.
Beth wondered what they thought she was going to be able to do, chained to the hospital bed. The hospital security guard got a swivel chair from somewhere and crammed it into the room, which pushed Mandy even further away from Beth.
For the love of all that's holy, Judge Pino said, are we ready?
Beth wondered if anyone would be brave enough to point out that he was the cause of the delay, but no.
Yes, we're ready, Your Honor, Mandy said.
Indeed, the prosecutor said.
The judge slipped on a pair of reading glasses and read the complaint out loud. Beth's name wasn't part of it, just her initials.
Do you understand what's going on here today? The judge asked.
Beth shook her head.
This proceeding is being recorded, ma'am, the judge prompted. You need to answer the question audibly.
Not really, she murmured.
Well, pursuant to Mississippi Code Section 97-3-37, Section 1 and Mississippi Code Section 97-3-19, Section D, you are being charged with homicide for intentionally causing the death of a child in utero. Under our state law, murder is defined as the killing of a human being without the authority of law when done with deliberate design to effect the death of the person killed. Also, under our state law, the term human being includes an unborn child in every stage of gestation, from conception to live birth. The charge is punishable by imprisonment for not more than 20 years or a fine of not more than $7,500 or both, because your conduct resulted in the miscarriage of that child.
20 years? Thought Beth. $7,500?
Both numbers were incomprehensible. The only miscarriage here, Your Honor, is a miscarriage of justice, Mandy interrupted. He leveled a glance at her.
I do suggest you watch yourself, Ms. DeVille. To Beth, he added, how do you plead?
I can explain.
No, Mandy instructed. Beth, I know you have things to say,
but don't tell them to anyone but me. I can keep what you tell me private. They can't. All you have to do now is say guilty or not guilty.
Not guilty, she whispered.
Where are the parents? Who brought her here?
The judge asked. Beth waited for someone to ask her. They were acting like she wasn't even there.
Damned if I know, Willie Cork said. Your bail recommendation, counselor? Given the serious nature of this violent crime against a voiceless, unborn child, and given the grave indifference that the perpetrator seems to show, I would request that she be held without bail pending trial.
You bastard, Mandy muttered.
I beg your pardon, Miss DeVille.
The judge raised a brow. I said he must be plastered to think that. She waved an arm in Beth's general direction. I'd respectfully request to waive a bail argument until my client is transported to jail. This isn't grave indifference, Your Honor. This is shock. This defendant is a child, Your Honor. A 17-year-old child who had an abortion in the confines of her own home.
My God, you yourself were once in the same position as that poor defenseless baby, Willie argued. The difference is that you were given a chance to exist.
Your Honor, if it please the court, may I say something? Judge Pino settled more heavily on his swivel chair.
Something tells me you're gonna, whether I say yes or not.
Mandy faced the prosecutor. Willie, you can stand on top of Mount Everest and shout that life begins at conception all you want, but if this hospital was burning down and you had to decide between saving a fertilized egg in the IVF lab or a baby in the maternity ward, which would you choose?
That's a false equivalence.
Which would you choose? Mandy repeated.
Nobody is trying to say it's all right to kill a child in place of an embryo. This is about allowing the embryo to be born and...
Exactly. Thank you for proving my point. No one truly believes that an embryo is equivalent to a child. Not biologically, not ethically, not morally. For a moment, the room was still. Then Willie said,
Unfortunately for you, the state of Mississippi does believe they're equivalent.
He flicked his eyes toward Beth.
There is no distinction in the law between whether she killed a grown adult or a fetus.
Allegedly killed, Mandy murmured by rote.
Except that had she murdered an adult, he could have cried for help.
The judge cleared his throat.
Ms. DeVille, we are a court of law, and in this state, all that need concern us is that the child that was in the defendant's body is now dead, and she was the proximate cause. For this reason, I am setting bail at $500,000. The defendant will have 24-hour surveillance while she is in the hospital, and upon discharge, she will be released to the county jail. Court is adjourned.
He hefted himself out of the chair and pushed past everyone else with the bailiff close on his heels. At the door, he turned to Beth.
And you, young lady, may God have mercy on you.
Beth was a devout Christian. She had worshipped Jesus. She had prayed to him. She had trusted him. She believed in God. She had her doubts, though, about whether God believed in her. It had been nearly an hour since Izzy put the chest tube into Bex, and she was running out of time. So much blood had drained out that it had soaked through two towels. Favor, Bex said. Izzy leaned down. Anything. You tell my niece, she wheezed, that this isn't her fault. You're going to tell her yourself, Bex. A smile played over her lips, a shadow behind her pain. I think we both know,
That isn't so, she said. She closed her eyes and a tear slid down her cheek. It's not the goodbye that hurts the most. It's the hole you're left with.
Izzy stared at her. She knew what it felt like to go without. It had been the guiding premise of her childhood. But she had never been what was missing. Once she told Parker it was over, she would be, though. Breaking someone's heart, it seemed, caused equal damage to your own. She didn't know anything about Bex, except for the fact that she was an artist, and that she had a niece who was somehow still miraculously hidden. Bex's life was a thread in someone else's tapestry, and that was really all that mattered. Izzy stood up and approached the shooter. This woman is going to die without medical help, she said.
Then fix her.
I've done what I can, but I'm not a surgeon. She looked around the waiting room. It had gotten painfully silent since he had smacked Janine across the brow and knocked her out. Joy was sitting with her. Janine had stirred a few times, so Izzy knew she wasn't dead. I heard you on the phone, Izzy blurted out.
What?
You know what it's like to lose someone you love. She stared into his empty eyes. All of us, we have families too. Please, we have to get her to a hospital. Before she could wonder if he would listen or shoot her, the phone rang. The first time George realized he was a superhero, Lil was only 6 months old. They had both gotten sick with the flu, and exhausted, George let her sleep next to him. But her fever had broken sometime before his, and she woke up and started to roll off the edge of the mattress. Even though he would have sworn he had still been asleep, George's hand snapped out and grabbed the baby by her foot before she could fall. He supposed that all fathers were like that. There was the time she was a toddler and got her foot stuck in the narrow slats of a fence in the pastor's backyard. Earlene had been babysitting while George had gone to get some fertilizer for the church gardens, and when he came back for Lil, he'd heard her hysterical cries. George was out of the car before he'd even finished slamming it into park. Earlene had tried everything and was in tears herself.
I've called 911. She told him, trying to soothe the baby.
Fuck 911, George said, and he smashed through the slats with his fist, grabbing Lil and cradling her against him, even as his bleeding hand stained her dress. Some of the hurts in the world weren't even physical. When Lil was 8, some little shit of a boy in Sunday school told her she couldn't play pirates with them because she was a girl. He had done for Lil what Pastor Mike did for him when he thought he was worth nothing. He began by pretending he had forgotten how to turn on the stove to boil the water for the spaghetti.
Dad, she said, rolling her eyes, you just turned the knob.
Can you show me?
And she did. Then he pretended that he couldn't remember how to use a hammer correctly. She curled her hand around his and patiently explained how to hit the nail, just a few taps at first, so that you didn't hurt yourself. He pretended that he didn't know how to replace a light bulb, how to clean the fishbowl, how to mix plaster, how to fly a kite. A few months later, they went to a church fair.
I don't think I remember the way back to the cotton candy, he told Lil.
He held out his hand, but this time, she shook her head.
Daddy, she said, you have to try. I won't always be here.
Her words had struck him so hard that he couldn't move, and panicked as she walked off and was swallowed up by the crowd. But she made her way to the cotton candy, just like he knew she would. It was one of the few times since he had come to the Eternal Life Church that he truly doubted the existence of God. What twisted deity would grant you the superpower of fatherhood to protect someone who, one day,
would not need you. On the 12th ring, George picked up the phone again.
Hello, Hugh said calmly. Everything okay in there? Don't act like you're on my team. I am, though, Hugh replied. I'm gonna make sure everyone listens to what you have to say so that this ends well for all of us. Oh, I know how this ends, George said. You call in your SWAT team and wipe me out like a mosquito.
There's no SWAT team here, Hugh said, which was actually true. They were still assembling. They had only been called 45 minutes ago.
You think I believe that you're the only cop out there?
There are other police officers here. They're concerned, but no one here is going to hurt you.
I bet you have a sniper trained on the door right now.
Nope.
Prove it,
George said. A shiver went down Hugh's spine. Finally, a bargaining chip.
I can prove it to you, George, and give you peace of mind. But I think you should have to give me something, too. I'm not coming out.
I was thinking of one of the people inside. I was thinking of my daughter, my sister.
It's true, they are pressuring me, George, to have a SWAT team assembled. But I said that you and I are having a rational conversation and that we should wait. If you send out a hostage, that's going to go a long way to convincing my chief that I'm right.
You first.
Do I have your word? Hugh asked.
There was a long pause.
Yes.
Proof there's no sniper. Now that he'd promised it, how did he execute that?
Hugh scrambled out of his command tent, still holding his phone. He ran down the sidewalk away from the clinic, blindly grabbing the first cameraman he could.
Dude, the guy said, backing up, hands off. Who do you broadcast for? WAPT?
Film me, Hugh demanded.
Now!
He lifted the phone to his ear again.
George, you still there?
Yeah.
Is there a TV?
Please God, let there be a television.
Turn on channel 16.
He heard a scuffle, and a yell, and the voice of a woman.
George, he asked, what's going on?
But he could hear his own voice coming from the TV inside the center now. The cameraman had the black eye of the camera trained on Hugh's face.
George, it's me. You can see what's going on behind me, right?
To the cameraman, he said, film that way, pan around me. Hugh kept narrating.
It's like I promised, George. No snipers, no SWAT team. Just some cops who are controlling the scene.
The camera swung back to focus on his face.
So, we have a deal, right? Who are you going to send out?
George found himself transfixed by the face on the television screen. Hugh McElroy was one of those men who looked tall, even if you couldn't see his whole frame. He had black hair that was military short, and eyes that looked like the blue heart of a flame. He was staring into the camera as if he could see right into George's mind. If he could, he would know what George was thinking. All those years with Lil that he'd believed himself to be her champion, he wasn't a hero. Hugh started speaking as if he could indeed read George's thoughts.
Whatever you did, George, and why ever you did it, doesn't matter. That's over and done with. What matters is what you do now.
George had given his word. He didn't believe that it meant anything to Hugh, really, but the fact that he'd asked for it had made George feel, well, respected, for once. George stalked toward the nurse, the bitch who kept reminding him that there were people bleeding all over the floor as if he couldn't see it himself, and hauled her upright by her arm.
Pick one, he said.
Izzy looked at Louie with her heart in her eyes. He nodded. Even if it felt like a Sophie's choice, Bex was the hostage who should be released. The rest of them stuck in this room might die, but Bex, if she stayed, would die.
You've got to get her out, Louis said.
Bex, Izzy chose. The shooter started dragging the couch and chairs and tables away from the front door where he'd stacked them like a barricade. Louis watched him, his eyes narrowed. He looked like any of 100 white male antis Louis had seen outside clinics. The vast majority of protesters were men, and it made perfect sense to Louis. The male of the species felt threatened by the biology of women. Even in the Bible, normal female biological functions were made pathological. You were unclean when you had your menses. Childbirth had to occur in pain. And there was the questionable nature of those who bled regularly but did not die. There was, of course, the history, too. Women had been property. Their chastity had always belonged to a man, until abortion and contraception put control of women's sexuality in the women's hands. If women could have sex without the fear of unwanted pregnancy, then suddenly the man's role had shrunk to a level somewhere between unnecessary and vestigial. So instead, men vilified women who had abortions. They created the stigma. Good women want to be mothers. Bad women don't. Vanita, God rest her soul, used to say that if men were the ones to get pregnant, abortion would probably be a sacrament. The Super Bowl halftime show would celebrate it. Men who had terminated pregnancies would be asked to stand and be applauded at church for the courage to make that decision. Viagra would be sold with a coupon for 3 free abortions. God. Louis missed Vanita already. 40 years ago, Vanita had had an abortion. It wasn't legal then, but everyone knew there was a woman in Silver Grove who worked out of her garage. When the woman died in the 1980s and her property got sold, and the new people tried to put in a garden, they dug up hundreds of tiny bones, the size of a bird's. Vanita told Louis that she herself dreamed of the baby she didn't have. She dreamed so vividly of arguing with her lost daughter that she woke up with her throat raw. Once she had dreamed of her daughter braiding her hair and woke up with it in neat cornrows. She was well aware that although abortion had been legalized, the stigma still existed, even though 1 in 4 women would have one. Vanita thought it was her personal calling to create a place where a woman could safely get an abortion if she needed one, a place where a woman could be supported and not judged. She had opened the clinic, and when she couldn't find a local abortion doctor, she'd tracked Louis down and asked him to fly in to provide services. He had never considered saying no.
I can't carry her, Izzy said, interrupting his thoughts.
There's a wheelchair.
Louis pointed to a spot where one was crammed beside a file cabinet, beyond Vanita's body. The shooter jerked his gun at Izzy, indicating she could get it. She ran behind the reception desk, past Vanita. She dragged the chair to where Bex lay, straddled the woman, and slipped her arms under Bex's armpits to lift her. With a struggle that Louis watched helplessly, she managed to get the woman into the wheelchair and retaped the plastic seal over the chest tube. Bex coughed and then fought for breath, adjusting to her new position.
You walk her out, the shooter said, and then you come right back, or I start shooting.
He grabbed the doorknob from the inside and swung it toward him, so that he was hidden behind the slab of wood. Sunlight fell into the room, silhouetting Izzy and Bex. That slice of light inched close to Louis as the door opened. He leaned a little to the left, wincing, until he could cup the ray in his palm. Suddenly he was 7 years old again, sitting on the porch while his grandmama snapped beans. The air was sticky,
and the wood under his thighs was hot enough to sear the backs of his legs. He stretched out his small hand, trying to catch the sun that spilled through the leaves of the cypress trees. He wondered if it had come to dance for him alone, or if it would put on its show even after he was gone. Noon. Hugh had been the third police officer to arrive. His unmarked car screamed to a stop behind a cruiser. He was immediately approached by two wide-eyed beat cops who'd been the first to reach the center after dispatch's all-hands-on-deck call reporting an active shooting.
"Lieutenant," one of the cops said, "what do you want us to do?" "What do we know so far?"
"Nothing," said the second officer. "We got here 10 seconds before you did."
"Have you heard any gunfire?"
"No."
Hugh nodded. "Until more backup arrives, position yourselves at the northwest and southeast corners of the building, in case the shooter tries to leave the building." The cops hurried away. Hugh started running a checklist in his mind. He would need the street cordoned off. He would need a command center. If the shooter wasn't coming out, he would need a direct line inside to speak to him. He would need to get rid of the people lining the street who thought this was entertainment. His personal cell phone was buzzing frantically in his pocket, but he ignored it as he reached into his car and called dispatch.
"I'm on site," he told Helen. "I'm securing the scene. Shooter's still inside, presumably with hostages. Has anyone gotten hold of the chief?"
"Working on it."
"Call the regional SWAT team and get them here," Hugh said, "and get me aerial photos of the center."
As he hung up the radio, three more squad cars arrived. He reached into his breast pocket, pushing the button on the side of his phone to dismiss whoever wouldn't leave him the fuck alone while he tried to keep a nightmare from becoming even more disastrous. When others were paralyzed by panic or overwhelmed by adrenaline, Hugh kept calm, steady, clear-headed. He didn't yet know if there were survivors inside the building, nor did he know what had happened that brought this gunman into a collision path with him today. But he would find out fast, and he would move heaven and earth to get the guy to put down his weapon before there was any more damage. Even as he instructed additional beat cops on how to secure the perimeter and what materials he needed to do his job, Hugh was praying. Well, maybe not praying, but pleading to the universe. Praying was for people who hadn't seen what Hugh had in his line of work. Praying was for people who still believed in God. He was fervently hoping that this asshole with a gun was one who could be easily defused, and that the shots he'd fired might have struck plaster or glass, and not people. Within minutes, Hugh was managing 30-odd police officers. He tapped impatiently on his thigh. He needed to have the area secure before he initiated contact with the shooter. This was his least favorite part of the process, waiting to begin the work. His phone began to buzz again. Hugh drew it out of his pocket. There were 25 messages from his daughter. There is a moment when you realize that no matter how well you plan, how carefully you organize, you are at the mercy of chaos. It's the way time slows the moment before the drunk driver crosses the median line and plows into your vehicle. It's the seconds that tick by between when the doctor invites you to take a seat and when she gives you bad news. It's the stutter of your pulse when you see another man's car in the driveway of your house in the middle of the day. Hugh looked down at the home screen of his phone and felt the electric shiver of intuition. He knew. He just knew. He clicked on Ren's messages.
"Help. There's someone shooting. I'm here with Aunt Bex. She's hurt. I don't know where she is. Dad, are you there? Dad, this is an emergency. I don't know what to do. Dad."
He stopped reading. His hands felt like lead and all his blood was pooling in his gut. Why was Ren in there? Why was Bex in there? He managed to type out a response. Where are you? The longest moment in Hugh's life was the breath he held until he saw those three little dots that meant she was typing. Hiding, she wrote.
Stay there, Hugh typed. I'm coming.
He should recuse himself. The whole point of hostage negotiation was to be clear-headed, and he couldn't be objective if his own daughter was a hostage. Staying in charge here would be against the rules. He also knew he didn't care. There was no way he was going to trust Ren's life to someone else. He started to run toward the clinic. To Bex, air had become fire, and every breath was charring her raw. Some tiny cell of self-preservation warned her to crawl somewhere, anywhere, that she could hide. But when she tried to roll to her side, the agony that stabbed through her made it impossible. The world went white at the edges. She stared overhead, her brain making patterns of the fluorescent lights and the tiles of the dropped ceiling. That was what artists did. They arranged the unarrangeable into something that made sense. When she created her canvases with their giant pixels, she was filtering impressionism through technology. The key to her technique was that the human eye, the human brain, did not have to see individual parts to imagine the whole. It was called Gestalt theory. Similarity, continuation, closure. These were some of the principles that the mind craved. It would complete lines that weren't fully drawn. It would fill in boxes that were empty. The eye was pulled to what was missing, but more important, the eye finished it. Maybe Hugh would be able to do that too, if she were gone. Finish her work. And yet she also knew that there was another tenet of art. The observer could easily miss what wasn't obvious. An optical illusion worked because the brain focused on the positive space of a chalice and not the negative silhouettes of the two profiles that formed it. But just because the viewer saw a goblet didn't mean the artist, while creating the piece, hadn't been wholly focused on those faces. Maybe one day Hugh and Ren would hold a gallery retrospective of her work. Maybe she would achieve fame by dying relatively young. And only then, maybe, would they realize they were the subjects of every one of her pieces. This was the worst pain she had ever felt. She opened her mouth to say their names, but found her throat was filled with the words of Leonardo da Vinci. While I thought that I was learning how to live, I have been learning how to die. Hugh was halfway to the front door of the clinic when he crashed into a cop.
Lieutenant, the officer said, this is Rachel Greenbaum. She's the one who called in the shooting.
He blinked. He had to shake his head a few times to clear it, to let go of Wren's name, which was caught like a bit between his teeth. What had he been thinking? Well, obviously he hadn't been. Charging inside was a mistake. He couldn't help Ren if he got himself shot.
Miss Greenbaum, he said, taking a breath, why don't you come with me?
Slowly, he loosened his death grip on his phone and slipped it into his pocket. He led her in the other direction, away from the clinic, away from Ren and Bex, goddammit, to a spot where two officers were hastily erecting a Tyvek canopy over a card table and a couple of folding chairs. There was also a laptop. He sat down and offered her a chair as well. The girl, he put her in her 20s maybe, had cotton candy pink hair and a hoop in her nose. Her mascara had run, giving her raccoon circles under her eyes. She was wearing a penny with buttons on it. Think outside my box. May the fetus you save turn out to be a gay abortion provider.
You work at the center?
he asked, reaching for a pad and a pen. She nodded.
I'm a jack of all trades. I do everything from escorting people in from the parking lot to admin to holding the hands of patients during procedures.
You were there when the shooter came in?
Rachel nodded and started to cry. Hugh leaned forward.
I know how hard this must be for you, but anything you can tell me is going to make the odds much greater that we can help your friends inside.
She wiped her eyes with her wrist.
I came in late this morning because my car broke down. I had just arrived.
Can you describe in detail what you saw?
The waiting room was pretty empty, Rachel said. That meant the group info session was finished.
Group info?
We have to do one every day for the next day's procedures. It's the law, she explained. There were only a couple of patients left, I think.
Was one a young girl, Hugh thought desperately, or a woman with eyes the same color as mine?
But the cop who had brought Rachel Greenbaum over was an arm's length away. He could not risk him overhearing.
Vanita was at the front desk.
Rachel looked up.
Vanita's the owner of the clinic, she said.
And then she started to cry again.
She's dead.
I'm so sorry, Hugh said evenly, but his heart tripped.
Wren had said that Bex had been shot.
Was she dead too?
She was drinking a diet shake. She hated diet shakes. We were joking around, and then the buzzer rang, and it was him.
Rachel glanced at Hugh.
We're not like Planned Parenthood, with security guards and metal detectors. I guess we operate on hopes of Southern gentility. We have protesters, but they keep to their side of the fence. And the center door is always locked, and there's an intercom. If you don't come in with a known escort, all you have to say is that you're there for an appointment, or that you're with someone who's there for an appointment, and then whoever is at the desk will push a button and let you in.
Was it unusual to have a man show up?
She shook her head.
We get boyfriends and husbands coming to pick up patients all the time.
Did he say he was there to pick up a patient?
No.
Rachel said quietly.
What did he look like?
I don't know. Ordinary. Shorter than you. Brown hair. Plaid shirt. A jacket.
She could have been describing half the citizens of Mississippi.
What kind of gun was he carrying?
I didn't see one.
Handgun, then, Hugh said. Not a rifle.
Rachel wiped her eyes as another police officer approached.
Lieutenant, dispatch came back with the plate registrations.
His first order had been to run the plates of every car in the parking lot. There were only a dozen. Now Hugh shuffled through the driver's license photos, subtracting out the women.
Any of these ring a bell?
Rachel hesitated at the first one.
This is Dr. Ward, she said. He works for us.
Then she turned the page.
That's him.
George Goddard, Hugh read. Excuse me a minute.
He picked up his phone and pushed a few buttons.
Dick? Yeah, I know. Listen, I have an active situation I'm working, and the hostage taker's got a car registered in Denmark. Can you do a drive-by?
He glanced down at the screen after he hung up. Wren had not texted again.
Did he say anything? Hugh asked.
I was going to lock up my backpack in Vanita's office, Rachel said. I heard him come in and come up to the desk, and Vanita asked if she could help him. I expected him to say he was looking for his wife or picking up his girlfriend or something. But he said, what did you do to my baby? And he started shooting.
What did you do to my baby? Hugh repeated. You're sure?
Yes.
Did he say anything else? Did he mention anyone by name?
I don't know.
Did it seem as if he'd been to the center before?
I'm not sure.
Did he seem like a local? Have an accent? She looked up at him.
Do any of us? Here in Mississippi?
Then what happened?
Rachel buried her face in her hands.
He shot Vanita. I ducked under her desk. I heard more shots. I don't know how many.
Did you see anyone else injured? Did you see my sister?
No. I tried to take care of Vanita, but she didn't. She wasn't.
Rachel swallowed hard.
So I ran.
She started sobbing.
Rachel, listen, Hugh said. You got us onto the scene fast. And thanks to you, now I know that the shooter isn't in there because he's on a philosophical crusade. This is personal, which will help me connect with him.
He leaned forward, his elbows on his knees.
You're lucky you got out.
The tears started falling harder.
I'm not lucky.
She sucked in the truth like she was breathing through a straw.
I saw him through the one-way glass, and he was wearing a coat. I noticed it because who wears a coat when it's 85 degrees? But I didn't stop to think about it. I just buzzed him in.
She folded into herself, an origami of grief.
What if I was the one who could have stopped it from happening?
This is not your fault, Hugh said. But it wasn't just Rachel he was trying to convince.
They had shown Joy into a recovery room after her abortion, where she had changed back into her sweatpants and baggy t-shirt and sat down to rest. As she reclined in a leather chair, she dozed, dreaming of when she used to babysit for a toddler named Samara, who lived next door to her foster family. Samara had the roundest cheeks and tiny Bantu knots and little white raptor teeth. She would do the hand motions to Itsy Bitsy Spider if you sang it to her, and she didn't like crusts on her sandwiches. Her mama went out twice a week to night school, which was when Joy would come over, feed Samara dinner, and put her to bed. Samara's mama, Glorietta, took a half hour to say goodbye to her daughter. She would smother her face with kisses and act like she was going to be gone for a year, not 3 hours. When she got home, she would go check on Samara and inevitably wake her up with her touches and hugs, even when Joy had worked hard to get her to go down. Sometimes Glorietta would come home in the middle of her class, saying she missed her baby too much and needed to be with her. She always paid Joy for the full amount of babysitting time, so it was a win-win. But Joy thought it was kind of strange, all the same. One night, Joy came home from practice to find 6 police cars on her street, and an ambulance pulled up in front of Glorietta's house. Samara was dead. Glorietta had smothered her in her sleep. She told the police it was so that her daughter would stay an angel forever. You never knew what went on behind closed doors, as any foster kid could tell you. Joy hadn't thought about Samara in years, but now she wondered, if a child died in the afterlife, did they keep growing up? Would Samara be there with Joy's child now? Would she babysit him? A scream woke Joy up. The sad woman was gone from the waiting room, and the playlist had ended. Just then, she heard a crash, the sound of glass shattering. Hello? She called, but there was no answer. She slowly inched to her feet.
She felt the pad in her underwear shift as she stood, and the hot rush of blood that came with being upright.